This is another instalment in the series of the Fortunates, or the Beatitudes. And this one, fortunate are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Now, let's see which side is which. Aha, right. So I did all my schooling at a school where the motto was wisdom and mercy. And we used to cynically say, and netball. And so although I don't remember very much about mercy, it was, after all, the years of corporal punishment. I know how to throw a netball so it completely takes out your opponent. So that's kind of unmercy. Anyway, when you look at all the words that are used in both testaments for mercy, there's always a couple of words in the passage together, and one of them means the attitude of mercy, but the other one means the action of mercy. So you always see a noun and a verb in the same passage. And I like the fact that they're intertwined, that it's not merely enough to think a merciful thought, but that mercy is a very active thing. So, let me do this one. Yeah. Now, mercy has two connotations or two meanings. The first is seeing a need and being compassionate, and the other one has the element of forgiveness in it. So, we'll look at the mercy as seeing a need and being compassionate first. There are many scriptures where people cry out to Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me, and or have pity on me. And the word pity comes from the word compassion or mercy in Latin, and it has the same Latin root as being pious, as in it's a kind of like a, you have a duty or an obligation also to show mercy to people. It's a good thing to do. So you have Jesus here. I don't know whether you can read that, so I'll read out thing there. Two blind men followed after Jesus, and they cried out, Son of David, have mercy on me. And Jesus healed them, and they spread the news. A Canaanite woman came out and cried out, you know, Son of David, have mercy on me. And her daughter was healed, and then she went and spread the word. And then two blind people heard that Jesus was passing by, and they cried out, Son of David, have mercy on me. They were shushed by the crowd, and then Jesus healed them, and then they followed Jesus. And lastly, blind Bartimaeus, who was begging at Jericho, heard Jesus was passing by, cried out, Son of David, have mercy on me, was once again shushed by the crowd, and Jesus healed him, and he followed him. There's another classic story of the that's often called the prodigal son, and I call it the prodigal father with the two sons, actually, the two lost sons. The key part that shows mercy, or one of the parts that shows one kind of mercy, is when the prodigal father, who's been keeping an eye out and sees his son in the distance, and runs and enfolds his son, which is a great example of compassionate mercy. The usual view in this parable is that the son had committed a culturally, he'd been deeply culturally offensive, and that he'd erred grievously, and that his father needed the forgiveness. And so it's often used as an example of the sort of mercy that shows clemency, that no matter what the boy had done, the father was going to show mercy. But there's another Jewish view. There's a theologian called Amy Levine, and her view is that the son had actually been very unwise in his life choices, but there's no evidence that he had lived a sinful life while he was away. The only slur about his riotous living is from the lips of his older brother, actually. And both the traditional view of it and the Amy Levine view show the young man who had gone away, the younger son, as practicing a pitch that would get round his father, something, you know, that sound religious, sound conciliatory, and hope to actually essentially get board and lodgings. But they both agree, both commentators agree, that the father, with his compassion and his love, overrode the prepared speech, and that actually caused a change of heart in the younger son. So, but there's another son, and what I... And often the other son is pitched as he failed to recognise his father's love, he traduced his father's love, and so forth. But you can also think about it, the father decides to put on a big feast for his son who's come back. It's actually going to involve killing animals, butchering animals, cooking large animals for a long time, preparing a lot of food for a lot of people. And the older son doesn't appear to have got a message that the father was so preoccupied with loving his younger son who had returned that he hadn't even bothered to send a message to his older son. And so the older son arrives, smells the smells, hears the sounds of the party starting up, and has to ask a servant boy what's going on. So the lesson I take from that is that perhaps the father had a wee blind spot in showing his mercy as well, and perhaps we all have blind spots about who we show mercy to. So the dramatic, the son's come back, prompts a response, but the everyday, that's the one that's easy to forget. So we now come to mercy as clemency or forgiveness. First of all, there has to be an actual offence for mercy to be required. And in the Aramaic chobba that Jesus uses in the Lord's Prayer, he includes both sins of commission or the sins of omission, that your debts, the things that you haven't done that you should have done, and commission, which is trespasses, the things that you did that you shouldn't have done. So whether we fail to do something that we should have done or we do something we shouldn't have done, both are sins. And we all do it often and all the time. And God's undeserved mercy is always shown to us. But it is difficult to show that same mercy to people who sin against us. And there's a parable about that which is completely, that Matthew 18, 23 to 27. So it goes, "For this reason, the kingdom of heaven is like a king who wanted to settle accounts with his slaves. And when he had begun to settle them, one who owed him 10,000 talents was brought to him. But since he did not have the means to repay, his master commanded that he be sold along with his wife and children and all that he had, and repayment made." Now, in antiquity, a denarius could buy 7 kilograms of wheat, and a talent is 6,000 denarii, which is 20 years of working a 6-day week on minimum wage. And 10,000 talents that this guy owed is actually the wages at that rate of 200,000 years, which is an astronomical, like absolutely astronomical. I mean, it's a parable, not a history. I'm thinking, gosh, that guy must have really had his hand in the till. Anyway, so the slave fell to the ground, prostrated himself before him, saying, "Have patience with me and I will repay you everything." And the master of that slave felt compassion and he released him and he forgave the debt. So we come to the next guy. But that slave went out and he found one of his fellow slaves who owed him 100 denarii. And he seized him and began to choke him, saying, "Pay back what you owe." So his fellow servant slave fell to the ground and began to plead with him, saying, "Have patience with me and I will repay you." But he was unwilling, and he went and threw him in prison until he would pay back what was owed. And this guy's debt was worth 700 kilograms of wheat. So much less. And, yeah. Anyway, so the next part of it is that when the fellow slaves saw what had happened, they were deeply grieved. They came and reported to their master all that had happened. Then summoning him, his master said to him, "You wicked slave, I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me. Should you not also have had mercy on your fellow slave in the same way that I had mercy on you?" And his master, moved with anger, handed him over to the torturers until he would repay all that was owed him. "My heavenly Father will also do the same to you if each of you does not forgive his brother from your heart." So in this parable, the unforgiving slave is condemned to face the consequences because he was forgiven, but he refused to extend that forgiveness to others. It wasn't just the gall of bitterness. It was the refusal to actively show mercy. And the interesting thing is, it doesn't appear that anybody in the story stole anything. They just borrowed and couldn't repay. Days before credit cards. Anyway, so now we come to the flip side, which is the destructive force of unforgiveness. Now, I have a really strong background in unforgiveness. We have generations of expertise. I sort of joke that, because I've done quite a lot of genealogical research, that my ancestors would have, they're on the opposite sides of most kind of conflicts of religion, of ethics, of nation, of, you know, whatever, of status, whole bit. And many of my forebears would have killed each other on sight. But I actually feel quite well adjusted. Anyway.
Done a lot of work, haven't you?
Yeah, right. So, and also too, I have a very... my family were a very fertile family, and so, you know, like on my maternal side, I had scads of aunts and uncles and cousins, and on my father's mother's side, I had scads of relations, and they all seemed to know each other. On my father's father's side, there was a blank, which I was very curious about, actually. My father didn't seem to know anything about it. So I did a bit of research and I found that his father came from a very large family and had a large family of cousins, and that there were living descendants, and that some of them had been trying to find us, which was nice. And so I made contact and I discovered a nasty story of unforgiveness, actually, over a very petty matter, I feel. Anyway, two guys arrived from Ireland in 1851. They left the potato famine. Their dream was to have land and pass the land on down through their family. So they worked themselves very hard, and both brothers got land. Both brothers had families. both brothers called their children by the same name because it's an Irish naming pattern. So it's very confusing, you know, like you've got two Johns born in the same year, two Catherine. You know, like they're just recycling names. It's very confusing. Anyway, so they both have sons, they both have daughters. The dream is for the sons to carry on the land. Well, the sons go off to the Boer War and things like that, and they move to the North Island and they don't actually want to take over the land. So the fathers decided, the parents decided that they were going to disinherit and disown and refuse to speak to these sons ever again. And they just acknowledged the daughters. And so I'm a descendant from a son, you see. And the interesting thing is that not only did they do that, but they actually spread slander about the young men's characters. And they even wrote family histories and things with these lies in them. And, you know, so, like, it was very vicious. And eventually I tracked down an old lady who was about 85 who'd actually been responsible for these unforgiving stories or slanderous stories. And I thought, so I wrote her a letter saying, well, actually, I know the descendants of the guys, and they're actually lovely people. They're good people. They, you know, they've done good stuff. And by the time the letter got to her, she was on her deathbed. And one of my cousins read her the letter, and they say this is the first time they ever heard her say this, but she said, perhaps I was wrong. So anyway, so that's that, you see. Like just cut people. And my grandmother on my mother's side, she was a widow and she was had eight children and she had a really, really hard life. They didn't have social welfare back in those days. And she also had no idea how to resolve conflict in a healthy way at all. And so she ended up having a bust up with each of her children in turn, and you know, the children were either cast out or left because of the bust up. And my mother was the youngest, and she'd seen all of her siblings cut off for crossing mother. So she was in great fear that she would offend her mother and be cut off herself. And my grandmother suffered. When she was in the throes of her most unforgivingness, she got so that she couldn't. She had very bad rheumatism that suddenly descended on her. She couldn't even dress herself. My mother, who was about eight, had to dress her mother and do up her shoes and things like that. So the family, the children, actually decided that they weren't going to let it stand, and so they all tried in their own way to build a relationship with their mother again, but she didn't know how to initiate anything like that. So anyway, so along comes me, and as a child I knew perfectly well how to cut offenders permanently, you know, like somebody offends you in the playground, well, they're not a very nice person, don't talk to them again. And we also practiced, we're really good at Schadenfreude, which is taking great pleasure in somebody else's misfortune. So you had to do it with cruel wit and panache, and then it was okay. So anyway, fast forward a few decades, and my mother became a Christian, and she discovered a Christian teaching tape on unforgiveness. And this was for her an absolute watershed moment, and she pirated off many, many copies of it, and she gave us all a copy, and she gave copies to her brothers and her sisters and anybody else she could think of, because it was a complete revelation to us that there could be another way to do it other than somebody offends you, that's the end. So we're really good at this. And what it does is, of course, it corrodes the spirit, it saps joy and contentment, and it actually hurts me far more than you. So Forgiveness instead. Peter had a conversation with Jesus about forgiveness, and he sort of says, "How many times shall my brother sin and I forgive him?" And Jesus said to him, there's a line missing there, I think, isn't there? He says, shall I forgive him seven times? Now, when you think about it, Peter thought he was being pretty magnanimous, say, of forgiving seven times. And you've got to say, we sort of minimise poor old Peter there for thinking, oh, he's being a bit economical with his forgiveness. But you think about it, somebody borrows your car and they return it with no petrol and crumbs throughout. Are you going to be as forgiving when they've done it the seventh time? That's a lot of forgiving. Or, people who don't realise that if you put dishes beside the dishwasher can't wash them. It's all these minor annoyances. Or people who won't clean the toilet after they use it. It's almost like it's easier to forgive something massive think of massive things, like the what?
Writing the car off.
Yeah, easier to forgive writing the car off, but not getting killed doing it, than the everyday annoyances. So Jesus, of course, says. In some versions, he says 77 times, and in some version, he says 70 times 7, which is 490. So, either way, it's a lot. I mean, 7's a lot enough without 70 times 7. So, there seems to be... there seems to be a tie-up between receiving forgiveness from God and forgiving other people, or showing mercy to others and having mercy shown to us by God. And in the Lord's Prayer in Luke, it says, "Forgive us for we forgive," which implies that we forgive and then God can forgive us. And in Matthew, it's "forgive us as we forgive," so it's sort of in parallel. And there's another one that I couldn't find, which is essentially the timing, I don't think, really matters. The fact that you forgive is the healthy thing, and that if you're being forgiving instead of unforgiving, then God is able to forgive us and we're able to receive God's forgiveness. So forgiveness does not mean evil or injustice is acceptable or should go unchallenged. And forgiveness doesn't replace justice or consequences. I'm thinking, like when you're a victim of sexual abuse or something like that, you don't necessarily expose yourself to the predator again. You can, absolutely not. And that you have a duty to protect yourself and your dependents from a danger. So I think you can still have the attitude of forgiveness, but forgiveness doesn't actually mean lay yourself down to be abused again. But what forgiveness does is enables us to get out of the way and let God go to work in the situation, and allows us to be part of a just process as well. And forgiveness heals us of the urge for revenge. It enables us to see the offender as God sees them, and exercise some compassion and understanding. And I think, using sexual abuse as an example here, I think sexual abuse is an awful thing, and you need to be protected from an offender. But often you look at the offender, and you find that the offender is also a victim, and that it's gone on and on and on and on. And so that tension of having a safe relationship, or having a relationship with enough boundaries, that a person who is damaged and damages other people can also be enfolded and loved and able to grow and whatever. And, yeah, we got quite a bit of experience of that too. Anyway, we live in a flawed world, actually, and we're all pretty flawed, really. Anyway, so I'm going to conclude with some takeaway mercy. So, mercy and forgiveness might be in short supply from humans, but God's mercy is boundless. That we ourselves need to accept God's forgiveness and mercy. And we need to pass it on. And we need to extend the same forgiveness to ourselves. I think sometimes it's very hard to forgive yourself when you've actually really messed up. Very, very hard. Am I greater than God? God forgives me. Am I greater than God to say I'm unforgivable? And you know that song, one of the songs that about, you know, Corrie Ten Boom used to talk about God throws our sins into the depths of the sea, and then he puts up a sign which says no fishing. So we don't need to wallow in it. And if we do accept his forgiveness, forgive ourselves and pass it on, we will indeed be more fortunate.